This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon. Thanks all for coming. It's a great pleasure to have Jane Silverthorne here at Boyce Thompson Institute and at Cornell tomorrow. She's been here before, but we never see enough of Jane. I want to make an announcement before I forget. This is for tomorrow, and the announcement is that all students and postdocs are invited to a Careers in Government panel, and it's going to be hosted by Jane and Chris Wetterstrand, who's visiting from the NIH. That's 2 p.m. tomorrow in G10 of the biotech building on the bottom floor opposite the big auditorium. So Careers in Government tomorrow at 2 in G10. So let me give you a little bit of background for Dr. Silverthorne, who's currently Deputy Division Director of the Division of Biological Infrastructure at the National Science Foundation, or NSF. Her academic background included a PhD at the University of Warwick in England. And then she came stateside for a postdoc with Elaine Tobin at UCLA. And one of her, and Elaine at the time, worked on light-regulated gene expression in plants, which is very close to my heart. And in that time, Jane published a very important paper in the National Academy, Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, showing for the first time that the light receptor, phytochrome, regulated transcription of nuclear genes. And of course, that's opened up a huge research area since then. She then went on to a faculty position at the University of California at Santa Cruz, rose through the ranks from assistant professor, associate professor, and professor. Now, around 1998, the decision was made in the government to start this program, which many of you are familiar with called the Plant Genome Research Program. And Jane was recruited to run that program and went to NSF for the first time in 1999. And she's really been the spirit of that program, which funds so much research on this campus and kind of the presence over all the projects in that program. And we owe her a great debt of gratitude for the way that she's managed that portfolio of projects and kept that science strong and well supported. And the Plant Genome Initiative is just going into its third five-year plan, so I was given this book last night. You can get this online if you want to see what it was decided by the interagency working group that plant genome should do in 2009 through 2013. And one of the important components is broadening the reach of that science, both into the practical aspects of agriculture, but also to the public in general, which is relevant to the sort of public nature of the talk that you're going to hear today, the relationship between basic science and the food supply. Now, apart from her assignment to plant genome, Jane, as I mentioned, is now in the Division of Biological Infrastructure. She also had an interesting assignment between 2006 and 2008, where she was assigned to what's called the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Now, this is an office that's in the Executive Office of the President of the United States. So during, this is now part of the Bush presidency, Jane was a kind of a liaison between the NSF and the White House involved in science and technology policy. And she tells me that it's been a very interesting experience. And obviously, science policy is critical as the government defines it. I just mentioned she's very widely traveled and represents National Science Foundation and represented OSTP in a number of working groups around the world, so a lot of frequent flyer miles. I don't know if you get to keep them or not. I think it's worth mentioning that from 2004 through 2008, she was received every year an Outstanding Performance Award from the NSF Bio Directorate. She's received an award for collaborative integration, program management excellence. So I think that all speaks to what many of us know is her extremely strong skills in program management. So without taking any more of your time, I'd like to give you the podium and tell us about Feeding a Hungry World.
Thank you very much, David. Can everybody hear me at the back? I have a rather quiet voice. Good, thank you. And just raise your arm if I start to dip down. I want to make sure everybody can hear. So first of all, I want to say how much I appreciate the invitation to come here and talk to you. This is an absolutely wonderful institution, the Boyce Thompson, as well as Cornell University, and I feel so privileged and fortunate to have a chance to spend time with you. I know you're all very busy, and I am overwhelmed by the generosity of everybody who has taken time to organize my schedule and also invite me into their groups and talk about their science. So I wanted to say thank you for that before I got going with my talk. So my talk today is entitled Feeding a Hungry World, and I think I want to give some take-home messages up front before I delve into what I'm going to talk about. I think one of the most important things that I think about every day is how can we use basic research to improve the world around us. And that includes feeding people who are not as fortunate as ourselves to have access to an abundant and safe food supply. And it's also really about how to engage the broader community, the public, in what we do to justify the relevance to everybody, the money that we spend, the taxpayers' money, and to make sure that everybody appreciates, understands, and loves the science as much as we do. And so I hope that in this talk I can give you some summary of the problems that we're facing and where I see science, and particularly the science at MSF, as contributing to some of the solutions. So this is a picture of a field in England somewhere, and this is where I grew up, in case you hadn't picked up on the accent. And I want you to notice a few things about that field, because I took those things for granted every single day of my life. I would walk out of the front door at home on the way to school, and there was a field not unlike this at the end of the street. And it was very carefully managed and farmed throughout the year by a local farmer, probably a mid-sized farm. In my area, they were growing mainly wheat and also hops for the local brewery. And I would periodically go for walks, and in fact, you can see in the field, I don't know if there's a pointer here, in the back there between the trees, you can see that there's actually a path. There are rights of way. Is it on there? Okay, so there are rights of way through many of the fields that are walked every year, at least once a year, to keep them open. And that was my relationship with agriculture, and it never occurred to me that that wonderful scenery that I took for granted that was outside my home and that I walked through on a regular basis was actually the source of food, believe it or not. And in fact, it was really brought home to me when I gradually learned about developing country agriculture and found out what it was like for other people. So the typical African farmer is actually a woman who farms about 1 hectare of land or less. She would have little or no access to any improved seeds, fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, or any form of irrigation. These farms are often scattered wide apart. There are issues with labor, as I just mentioned, issues to many access to many of the inputs that we take for granted in our agriculture. And the Green Revolution really bypassed this kind of farmer. And so as a result, there have been tremendous issues internationally with regard to access for food, particularly in Africa. So this is what a farm field would often look like in Africa. This one's been invested with Striga, a parasitic plant that I'll be talking about in just a moment. And as a result of these kinds of challenges, more than 820 million people live in chronic hunger. About 3/4 of the 1.1 billion people living on less than a dollar a day or the equivalent actually live in rural areas like this. And most rely on agriculture for food and income. So if we're going to improve their circumstances, we really have to consider what it is that's contributing to the problems and begin solutions. And in my opinion, those solutions have to include science-based solutions. Now, you can tell that this is a major issue because in the last year alone, there were a number of major reports that were published from some of the different stakeholder groups working in this arena. On the left is an executive summary of one of a series of reports that were put out by the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development, which was led by the World Bank and started in around 2002. And there are a whole series of reports. There's the synthesis report as well as a number of regional reports that consider issues around the world from the perspective of a broad collection of stakeholders. These documents are all available online if you want to read them. This particular document has some interesting perspectives in it. In the middle, we have another report from the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, which publishes regular reports containing statistics on the state of food insecurity in the world. The last one was in 2008, and I'm actually going to show you a few of the figures from that report so you can get a sense of the scope and scale of the problem. And then the report on the right was actually commissioned by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in about 2006. And it is called Emerging Technologies to Benefit Farmers in Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And this report was published in January of this year. and I will also be mentioning some of their findings from talking to farmers who are dealing with some of the issues that I've just mentioned. So the first point that I want to make is hunger is increasing. For many years, the benefits from the Green Revolution, which lasted from about the 1940s to about the 1970s, and it was a concerted effort at improving breeding and cultivation practices that I think had a tremendous impact in Asia, particularly in irrigated areas, led to increases in yield that were able to outpace the increases in population. And it was because of the original Green Revolution that we didn't have the population catastrophes and the hunger catastrophes that were predicted. But you can see that although there have been some benefits, in the last few years, hunger has started to increase again. And so we have an increasing problem that we need to deal with. So where are the undernourished people in the world? I think what is quite surprising to me is if I had not known anything about this, based on what I read in the news, I would have assumed that sub-Saharan Africa would have been the major area. In fact, it's actually India. And there are other areas that are also still very challenged, including China, although, as you'll see in a moment, China has made significant improvements in its ability to feed itself. So I think you can see that if you look at the green bars, which is 1990 to 1992, then compare with the blue bars, which are 1995 to 97, and then the most recent data, 2003 to 2005, then in fact, China is actually making inroads into its undernourished populations through a combination of approaches that does include increased investments in science. However, what you can see is in India, in fact, hunger is increasing. In India, in fact, the dietary energy requirements outpace supply now, and so, in fact, the issue there is probably going to be more compelling and pressing than perhaps it appeared from the previous picture. So one of the things that I found very interesting in the NRC report that came out in January is what scientists and people working in agriculture felt about agricultural constraints in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia from their perspective. And one of the most useful and interesting pieces of information in that report is a table that just lists their top, what they consider as a group to be the major constraints. And I've listed all of them here. Obviously, soil fertility is one. In countries in Africa where they were not able to improve yield and population was increasing, they extended the areas in which they were cultivating. And practices which had been sustainable over many years, such as rotation of crops and leaving fields fallow, were no longer done, and so the soil has rapidly become depleted. And in fact, because they don't have access to irrigation in many cases, issues with rainfall, infrequent rain or too much rain, really have a negative impact on the soil. It's very difficult to manage water because so many of the fields are rain-fed, they're not irrigated. In addition, they have issues with animal nutrition, diseases, and vectors of diseases. Some of the other issues that are in green are things that I think science, basic research, can have an impact on. The next one down in the green list is the animal and plant germplasm, and I'm sure that resonates here. We have an extraordinary diversity of plant and animal germplasm, but the kind of cultivation practices we have, as illustrated by that vermiform, uniform-looking cereal field that I showed you in the second slide, these are not necessarily things that have been best suited to the local practices in the countries that are suffering deprivation. In addition, the farmers, as well as access to extension and information systems, are facing real educational problems. They really don't have access to the knowledge and information that could really help them decide on the best approaches to be used. There's a desperate need for technologies to increase productivity in these systems, and I think this is one of the areas in which we can have a significant impact. As I mentioned, there are parasitic weeds which although they sound like they would be an annoyance, actually are devastating to yield in the crops that they affect, and in fact can lead to complete crop loss in bad years. And finally, I think all of the information and resources that we're benefiting from in agriculture in the US just are not accessible. But this isn't totally a science-based issue. So there isn't a single magic target that you can identify and fix. This is not a simple, clean fix problem. It is actually a series of very complex interrelated problems that span all the way from very basic agricultural practices that are influenced by science and technology, all the way through to market-related conditions. Even if a farmer is able to improve yield and actually have a surplus, how are they going to access markets and be able to sell what they make? Weak government and institutions and finance for small farmers really impact what farmers can actually do in the way of having access to new improvements. And in addition, there is a lack of infrastructure, a lack of energy and mechanization for small farmers. And then, of course, they're all facing what we're facing, which is a changing climate and all of the problems that come with that. So basically, all of this is happening. You have an increasing population. And so this is not going to be a simple set of problems to solve. But because I'm an eternal optimist, and in fact I've been described as relentlessly upbeat, I'm not willing to give up. I think we have to identify the problems that we can solve and work on them. So there are some aspects of these problems that are solvable, and here's one. It turns out that if you do actually supply input in demonstration farms, you can actually improve yield quite dramatically in a wide range of farm areas. So this is something that if you could actually bring these improvements to a wide range of farm situations, you could actually have an impact. And in fact, what's interesting to me is as people have had access to fertilizers, you can see, in fact, there has been an increase in fertilizer use, with the exception of sub-Saharan Africa, where, in fact, the infrastructure, the road infrastructure is so bad, and the access to the necessary investments to be able to use these resources are not available. The other thing to realize is that even within single countries, there is a tremendous diversity of yield in farming situations depending on who's doing the farmer and what they have access to. And this slide, which I got from Debbie Delma, I think illustrates this very well. So a typical small farmer will get a yield that's about a tenth of what a large commercial farm will get when they have access to resources that enable them to improve their farming practices. On top of all of this, we have a huge range of fungal diseases which are becoming an increasing problem as the climate changes. The range in which these diseases are now found is changing. The vectors are changing, and this is leading to unpredictability in where they're going to be problems, and also new impacts on crops that didn't used to be impacted. And I've listed four here. Obviously, you'll be very familiar with wheat rust here since Cornell has one of the Bill and Melinda Gates projects to look at rust. But there's also soybean rust, and soybean rust is not just a problem elsewhere, it's a problem here. And in fact, since it arrived in the US, we've been waiting for the next outbreak. And so these are issues that we have to worry about too. Other diseases that are really an issue are late potato blight, which is extremely difficult to control and can lead to complete loss of a crop in a given year. And I've listed two other diseases below, black sigatoka of banana and gray leaf spot in maize that also have significant impacts on yield. So when you have these diseases in your subsistent crops and you lose yield or you lose your crops completely, you really have absolutely no fallback. Not only are fungal diseases a problem, Gemini viruses are also a serious threat. And in fact, there are two cases where, in fact, resistance in plants has been lost. One is to the cotton leaf curl virus, and the other is cassava mosaic virus. The mosaic virus in cassava is actually one of the major impacts on yield. And in situations where that is the security crop, the crop of last resort, it could be a very serious issue. So the other problem that I alluded to, and the last one I'm going to focus on for now, are parasitic weeds. Now, this is actually supposed to be a cornfield, and you can actually see corn stalks. But mostly what you see are these rather pretty pink flowers, which are actually Striga. It's a parasitic plant. And I'm going to tell you more about that in a moment, because we fund science that looks at the Striga life cycle and how it might be modified. It turns out that parasitic weeds are a much bigger problem than you could imagine. Over two-thirds of the 73 million hectares of farmland that are cultivated for cereal grains and legumes in Africa are infected with one or more of the Striga species. And you can see in this field, the yield is going to be rather low at the end of the season. So there are a lot of players in this field, and I don't even have all of them on the slide here. The point that I want to make is that, as I mentioned earlier, these are issues that are very complex, they're interconnected. There isn't a single solution, and in fact, there isn't a single entity that can deal with all of them. And each of these entities here deals with part of them. I think you're probably very familiar with the activities of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation through its global health, global development program in the areas of agriculture, not just in terms of fighting diseases, but also dealing with some of the downstream issues. It also partners with other entities. It's partnered with the McKnight Foundation. It's partnered with the Rockefeller Foundation for a green revolution for Africa. So there are certainly a lot of support now being put into projects. And a pivotal part of many of these projects are actually these labs that are listed up on the left, which form the Consultative Group for International Agricultural Research. And in fact, they are partners in a number of the projects that I'm going to be talking about, and are a very important part of some of the solutions to these problems, because they operate locally, and they have often the local germplasm and the understanding of many of the local issues that are being addressed. And there's one that's not on here, and I like to think that NSF, which just popped up in the right, is going to be part of these issues in the future. We have been involved a little bit in the beginning, and I'll tell you how, but I'm really hoping that in the coming years, we're actually going to play a more and more significant role. So where does NSF fit? Well, NSF is a very interesting entity for those of you who've never visited us or don't know very much about us. So NSF is actually what's called one of the independent federal agencies. It was started in 1950. It grew out of a wonderful paper written by Vannevar Bush, who was one of the president's science advisors. And he had the vision of creating what he called a National Research Foundation, which was essentially going to provide funding for scientists to do basic research in science and engineering. And actually back then, before NIH, the health stuff was done at his the National Science Foundation and was in his visionary plan. So these days, NSF is the funding source for about 20% of all federally supported basic research in America's colleges and universities. And I should give the disclaimer that this does not include the ARRA funds. These numbers were calculated before the stimulus funds, and we're actually going to become a double-digit agency for the first time in our history as a result of the stimulus funds. NSF has a wonderful peer review system. It's bottom-up funding. Proposals come in, solicited or unsolicited. They're reviewed by panels that are made up of scientists like yourselves. And as a result of all of those review activities, NSF funds about 10,000 research grants a year. NSF does not fund in-house research of any kind. We have one research facility at the South Pole. But other than that, everything is done in universities and colleges and institutions of learning. So my interest in where NSF can fit in, I think, is best summarized by one of the introductory statements in the NRC report that was commissioned by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And they said that their study was predicated on the fact that the historical increase in agricultural productivity in the United States occurred largely through scientific and technological innovations. And so I am a firm believer that basic research can feed into this pipeline of discovery and lead to improvement. Obviously, it isn't going to be a solution alone, but I think it's a very important solution because, frankly, dealing with some of the challenges in the field, whether it's accessing and using the right germplasm or dealing with parasitic weeds or understanding long-term durable disease resistance has to come from an understanding of the biology of the organisms that you're working with. And so I actually am very optimistic that this is where we can have an impact. So a lot of basic plant research is actually funded at NSF already, and a lot of it is happening here. First of all, there are what we call the core programs in the biology directorate in NSF that support the individual investigator grants that many of you have to study basic processes. And actually, some of the international components of those are supported through the Office of International Science and Engineering at NSF. The program that's had a huge impact has been the Plant Genome Research Program, and as David mentioned, this started in 1998 as part of the National Plant Genome Initiative. And this program funds basic research on a genome-wide scale, and it also funds a lot of the tools and resources that are required to enable basic research. So whether or not you've ever been part of a plant genome grant, the chances are that at some point you have used a tool or resource that has been generated through plant genome funding. And those tools that are being developed are actually not only useful to research in this country, they're useful to research everywhere. Many of them are basic and can be translated and applied to other crops and plants used in other countries. In recognition of this, in 2003-2004, the Plant Genome Research Program actually set up a separate component called the Developing Country Collaborations in Plant Genome Research. And I was very excited that we could do this because I had been part of a group that had been involved in setting up a genomics conference in India to discuss issues where there could be potential collaboration between US and Indian scientists. And so this was a program to jumpstart those activities. And its main goal was to support collaborations between developing country researchers and scientists in the Plant Genome Research Program projects. It was originally developed with the idea that we could partner with USAID with funding. When that didn't pan out, we were actually still able to carry it out with their support in other ways. So the Plant Genome Research Program, as I mentioned, started in 1998, and its major focus is on plants of agricultural importance, as well as plant processes of potential agronomic value in the U.S. It is a very U.S.-centric program. The research areas include structural genomics through many of the expression tools, bioinformatics, databases, and so on. One of the important things about this program is that training and outreach activities are built into all of the projects, and many of the projects that have international collaborations do so through the developing country collaborations. As I mentioned, the tools and resources that we develop through this program are broadly useful and can be applied. And in fact, one of the operating principles of National Plant Genome Initiative is that everything that is developed, whether it's a resource, whether it's data, whether it's germplasm, all of it should be rapidly released and shared in public repositories that are readily accessible. Coordination through the activities at USDA, DOE, NIH, and USAID occur through the National Plant Genome Initiative, and you just saw at the beginning of this talk the five-year plans that we use to coordinate our activities. And this is very important because although the Plant Genome Research Program does basic research at the very beginning end of the spectrum, its impacts are felt all the way down through the chain of translation into the field through the interactions and support that are provided by our partner agencies in the NPGI. And I think this is going to be critical to leveraging the investments that we make not just in U.S. agriculture but also in the developing country collaborations and what we plan to do next. So I want to give an example of the kind of project that we're funding in the Plant Genome Research Program. This is a regular plant genome project. It's called the Parasitic Plant Genome Project, and it's completely focused on parasitic plants, including Striga. The scientists are all located in the US, but they actually hope to attract developing country partners through a database that they have set up. The link is here if you're interested in going to it. And they've chosen to focus on three particularly problematic parasitic plants, Triphasaria, Striga, and Orobanche, and all of these plants cause significant yield losses. So why are these plants such a problem? I think showing the Striga life cycle gives you some idea of why they have been such a challenge to agriculture. So at the top of the slide, you can see the flowers that you saw in that cornfield. And this is the tip of the iceberg, literally. The really bad stuff's going on under the soil, and quite some depth, actually. So the seeds get dispersed, and after they ripe, they imbibe and they germinate. And there are a whole series of cues that they pick up on in the soil from the plants around them. And they actually go over to the plants and they attach themselves, and they essentially suck the life out of the plants. And then the whole cycle begins again. And basically, if you want to control these things, you can't pull them up because the seeds are still down there. They're attached to the plants, so you damage the plants anyway. If you want to apply chemicals, it will be very difficult to do that, because how would you get to the parts that are really the issue? So using the conventional approaches with regard to chemicals really hasn't worked very well. And in fact, attempts to breed Striga-resistant plants haven't really worked very well either. And so what this project is going to do is go back to first principles. So parasitic plants, as I mentioned, devastate yields for a whole range of crops. And as I said, the control is extremely costly and difficult with chemicals. It basically doesn't work, and breeding doesn't work either. So what this project is doing is taking a biology-based approach, and it's actually leveraging resources that were developed through the National Plant Genome Initiative in a non-parasitic plant, Mimulus, the monkey flower, and leveraging those over to these three target species that are on a pathway to becoming parasites. And in fact, these particular species were chosen because they each represent a different stage. So the origin of parasitism, which is characterized by the ability to make that little tube that sucks the life out of the plant, started before Triphasaria. And Triphasaria is a plant that can live quite fine by itself, but if it finds something nearby that it can parasitize, it will move on over, pick up on signals, presumably that it's picking up in the soil, and then begin the parasitic life cycle. Striga is something that is photosynthesis and can generate its own resources and nutrients, but it is a very effective parasite on a very wide range of plants, as you saw. In the most extreme example, Orobanche or broom rape, it's not green, and in fact, it's not capable of making its own nutrients at all. It actually relies on the plants that it parasitizes. And because these are evolutionarily related, we have the possibility to look at the genome sequence of monkey flower, which is available, and the sequences of these different plants, and actually identify the genes in the networks that led to the development of parasitism, and actually develop a method for control that involves targeting those specific genes and networks. And I think this kind of approach is probably what it's going to take to be able to control parasitic weeds of these classes. So this kind of project, it lends itself very well to developing country collaborations. And so what I want to do now is talk about three of the projects that we've supported through the Developing Country Collaborations Program, which, as I mentioned, started in 2004 in consultation with USAID. And the way this program started, because we didn't have any funding other than what we had in Plant Genome, was to supplement ongoing grants that had activities that they could add to their projects, generally existing partnerships or partnerships that they were able to identify once the opportunity became available. In subsequent years, we actually funded these activities as part of regular grants. They would be built in as part of those training and outreach components that I mentioned earlier on. And the goal of this program, pure and simple, is a greater and sustained engagement with developing countries in plant biotechnology research. And specifically what we want to do is target local crops and traits that are most relevant to the farmers and consumers in the local countries. So really build on what we've already developed and take it to the next level. And the NSF funding can support a wide range of activities in those projects. It can support the travel between the scientists between the locations involved, the salary expenses during visits, and that means for developing country scientists to come to the U.S. and participate, as well as U.S. scientists who go to the developing country partner groups. And in fact, in almost every project, I think if not every project, there is a reciprocal exchange because we feel that there's a learning experience that goes beyond just sharing data and working on common problems. It's really being there in the flesh and seeing what the issues are and getting to know the people that you're working with. But the problem is there's a serious limitation with this program, and that is that the NSF funds may not be used to support research and training activities or the developing country personnel at their home institutions. What I mean by that is that unlike a U.S. grant where you have a lead investigator, what we call the principal investigator or PI, who can make subawards to collaborators and fund their activities as part of the project, if that collaborator is abroad outside the U.S., that funding cannot be provided. So NSF has been looking for a number of interesting ideas in these developing country collaborations. We wanted to make them more than just an exchange of ideas. We really wanted innovative ideas that would build on what we already had, that were truly reciprocal partnerships with these meaningful exchanges and long-term vision for the research. We were hoping that these projects would jumpstart something that could perhaps be picked up by one of the other partners that are active in this area that I showed you in one of the earlier slides. And unfortunately, there is not a clear pathway at this time, or there wasn't, for who was going to pick those things up. Although I will say that some of the projects have been picked up, and I'll mention one of them in a moment. So to date, we funded about 25 projects in this area. There are collaborations around the world, including in India and in Africa, as well as a number of other countries, and a wide range of crops, including some of the staples that you're familiar with and that we grow in the U.S., as well as crops that are grown internationally rather than here. So the first one that I want to talk about is nitrogen use efficiency in corn. And this is a project that's led by Steve Moose at the University of Illinois. And he's collaborating with the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture. It's one of those CGIAR centers that I mentioned in an earlier slide. And also collaborating with the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. And Steve's project is a US-based project, and what he's trying to do is identify the genes that that influence the accumulation of metabolic indicators of nitrogen status that are highly correlated with agricultural agronomic productivity. So what this basically means is plants that use nitrogen better. If we could understand the genes that enable plants to use the input better, then we could use fewer inputs and maybe lead to higher yield. And he wants, through this project, to develop solutions to the problem of reduced yields on low fertility soils with low inputs of fertilizer, one of the problems that was identified by the scientists in the Gates program. So what he's using for this project is something that has been developed over more than a century, a series of lines that were developed in Illinois. And I'm just showing one set here. This is the Illinois high protein and low protein lines that have been going for, as I say, over 100 years. This is a continuous selection project on corn. And you can see the high protein lines over time, the percentage of protein has gone up quite dramatically over the 100 years. And in the low protein lines, the percentage has gone down. What's interesting is halfway through the project at cycle 48, they actually started going backwards in each set. So they tried to take the high protein lines and drive them back down to low protein, and take the low protein lines and drive them back up. Now, why would you do this? It doesn't make any sense on the face of it. But actually it does, because if you want to understand the networks that are involved in nitrogen utility, you actually want to find out what the genic changes have been in these plants and then translate them back to how the nitrogen is being used. And the collaboration with the University of Ibadan is actually very interesting. They're taking local varieties and actually understanding the nitrogen networks in those varieties using the information taken from these Illinois lines and testing those lines in the field in Nigeria with the hope that they can eventually select lines that will perform better in those areas with those inputs. So that's one example. The second example is a local one, and I saw these slides from Susan McCooch. She's probably cringing at the back here. I love this project. I think it is one of my favorite projects that we funded, and it is part of a research grant that Susan has working on transgressive variation in rice. And it is a short course called Rice Research to Production at IRI, which is another one of those CGIAR centers, the International Rice Research Institute, which is shown on the bottom left. And the great thing about this course is this is not just a course where Susan stands in a lab and tells everybody about molecular markers and what you can do to improve rice. This involves the whole gamut from the classroom-based seminars and discussions to understanding the problems, visits to facilities and labs, and then actually going out in the field, talking to farmers and visiting partner institutions. It's a wonderful experience. It is a complete comprehensive approach to understanding rice research and production. And I love this slide. I stole it from a presentation that she gave to us on developing country collaborations, because you can see molecular biology students out in the field actually understanding what it takes to produce rice. So for the students that take this course, they're not just learning about rice improvement, they're actually seeing it in practice. And the quote at the bottom, I think, is absolutely marvelous. In case you can't see it, it says, "As a molecular biology student, it's easy to lose sight of all of the other aspects of rice research. The fieldwork showed that side of rice I rarely think of while in the lab." And what a wonderful course, because you know that every single person who's been there is going to come back and think very differently about the importance of their work and where they should be focusing their efforts. And this course was recognized in Science last year for its impact in part of the process of inventing new kinds of rice to feed the world. And I think the quote here on the right is marvelous. "There are students of molecular biology for whom rice is a series of A's, G's, T's, and C's. This course offers hands-on experience in rice production and helps network rice researchers throughout the world." And I have a feeling that by the time Susan retires, should that ever happen, you know, the entire rice research community will be networked. And just so you understand that Susan's outreach doesn't just extend to people in developing countries, this is actually rice researchers in the US were in Stuttgart, Arkansas, and you may notice a number of grants administrators out in the field with Susan learning about rice breeding. And I must say that's the first time I'd ever been in a rice paddy, and it was a remarkable experience. I had no idea that it could be like that. So the other project that I want to highlight is an example of a project that has been able to take basic research knowledge that's been developed through the Plant Genome Program and take it all the way through to the field and beyond, and with funding from other agencies. And I have a particular appreciation for Doug Cook, and perhaps I'll explain why. I mentioned that I was involved in organizing a meeting in India, I believe in 2003. And one of the scientists who came to that meeting was Doug, and he had never been to India before, but he had initiated a collaboration with scientists at another CGIAR center called ICRISAT. And he was very interested in taking that collaboration and extending it. And the meeting was held in Bangalore, and we went sightseeing as a group in Bangalore before the meeting started. And they were in the middle of retarring the road, and we had to wait at the roadside to get across while the person who was throwing tar down with a bucket walked past us. And a young girl reached up and tugged on Doug's sleeve, and he looked at her. He was quite taken aback. He thought that she was begging, and she was holding a baby, and the baby had a maggot crawling out of its eye. And Doug was absolutely transfixed by this, to the degree that when he came back to the United States, he changed the focus of his whole program. And his program, while he still looks at evolutionary origins of disease resistance genes in legumes, he's actually taking the information he's learning and turning them into very robust breeder-centric tools that can be used in developing country agriculture. And he's had extensive collaborations, mainly in India. He's actually really united the entire Indian research community in this field. And the fact is, before he organized his first workshop on legume breeding using molecular tools, many of the scientists in India working in this area had never met. So this is another example of where it's more than just putting the funding in, it's really building the networks. And as you'll see, in countries like Africa, they rely on a very broad range of crops, and legumes play a very important role, as they do in India, in providing a source of protein in the diet. And Doug's work initially focused on Medicago. I think he still does work a lot with Medicago in other projects. But the sequence tools that have been generated can be used to understand disease resistance. And so this is a very complex slide, and you really need to look at the block of colors, because what this is a cladogram of the resistance genes that he's been working on, and he's able to use markers for these groups of resistance genes and actually correlate them with germplasm that has disease resistance. So using these kinds of tools, and this is a basic evolutionary project, but developing tools that are actually relevant to the farmers that want to use them, the scientists who want to use them, he can actually ensure that they are taken downstream. And he's now working with Gates funding to be able to develop tools that are much broader than even he expected to be able to develop. So this is the project's website, and as you can see, he's working on a wide range of legumes that are staple crops in India, including some that you may not recognize, like cowpea and pigeon pea. The other thing that I want to say is that, as I mentioned, he is collaborating with a lot of scientists, and like Susan, he's really networking researchers working on a wide range of aspects of the problems that are impacting Indian agriculture. But there are some gaps in his ability to do things, and in fact, gaps in what we can do in NSF. And the first one is, as I highlighted in the beginning, NSF in these developing country partnerships cannot provide funding to the developing country partner. And it's very hard for us to support the science-informed approaches that are tailored specifically to the needs of smallholder farmers. And so we are very excited to announce a new program called Basic Research to Enable Agricultural Development, or BRED. And we announced this 1 week ago. It's been almost 2 years in the making, and I just cannot tell you how excited I am that we're finally going to be able to do the things that we've hoped to be able to do, which is to really connect our basic research resources all the way through the chain of the various entities that I showed you on previous slides to actually really hopefully begin to have an impact on the many problems that I highlighted at the start of my talk. So if you're interested in a press release and you haven't seen it, it's up on the NSF website. I think it's actually up on the front page still. And BRED is a partnership with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It is a true partnership. We're not contractors for the Gates Foundation. The way it works is that both the Gates Foundation and NSF have put $24 million each into this program over 5 years, with an agreement that there's a potential to extend it should it be going well. And I would say that this is a minimum dollar amount, because we're hoping certainly at NSF that we're going to attract other funds beyond the ones that we've committed. What I think is unique about this program is that it brings together the track record of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in agricultural development. And don't forget, they're not just funding research, they're also funding all of those other connectors that enable discoveries to get out into the field and be implemented. So it brings all that together with our peer-reviewed marketplace for new ideas in NSF, that bottom-up research that I mentioned at the very beginning of my talk. And best of all, it allows us to support the international partners with the Gates funding. So for the first time, we have a truly fully funded project that could allow development of tools that are specifically for developing country farmers and could potentially be taken all the way through. Now, the scope of BRED, I think this is very important. The program solicitation isn't out yet, and as you'll see, there's a website where you can go and find out when it is out. But what we're interested in BRED, are your novel, imaginative, and creative ideas from all fields of science, not just biology, that lead to generation of sustainable science-based solutions to problems of smallholder agriculture in developing countries. The kinds of things that we'll be looking for initially will be improvement of existing crops development of new crops, increasing crop productivity, and development of efficient production practices. But you should understand that this is more than just crops. If you're working on insects that impact plants, if you're working on ways to generate new kinds of fertilizers that could amend soils in a way that allow them to release nutrients better, hold water better, we're interested in those projects. Any good idea that is very basic but has a clear pathway, if it's successful, to making a difference in the field, we're interested in those projects. So please don't talk yourself out of applying. If you're not sure, then call us and talk to us. I want to be clear about what BREAD is not. It's not a top-down directed program. So we're not going to tell you what we want. We're not going to put out a list of questions that we'd like to be solved and then ask you to submit proposals to solve them. It's not that kind of program. We're not interested in supporting basic plant research without a developing country focus. And I think the easiest way to determine whether your ideas fit or not is if you could put your proposal into a regular NSF core program or the plant genome program, then it probably doesn't fit in BREAD. We're not in this program going to be supporting the downstream research. We're really hoping that if you have successful projects and they do well, that they will get picked up by other entities downstream. And I'm sure the Gates Foundation will be looking very carefully to see whether anything would meet their goals. And we're also, unfortunately, not able to give the funding directly to international partners. They have to come through subawards to U.S. institutions, and that has to do with the way that NSF makes grants. So if you're interested in more information about BREAD, we have a website. It's updated regularly. And the contact information is there for the wonderfully talented program director that we've recruited to run it. Many of you may know her. It's Dr. Deborah Delmer, who used to work at the Rockefeller Foundation and has been a consultant for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for a number of years. The contact information is here on the slide. We have a working group that actually manages the BREAD program, so that's why the email address doesn't look like her name. And I just want to say that we weren't the only people who made an announcement last week. So President Obama was actually at the G20 meeting last week, and on April 2nd, he held a press conference, and I'm not sure how many of you heard what he talked about at the press conference. He actually issued two fact sheets after that press conference, and here's one of them. And I just want to highlight a couple of things on it. I actually wasn't aware this had come out until the director of NSF sent a message saying, isn't this wonderful? Think about how this will fit with BREAD. So what President Obama is calling for in this press conference is to double the U.S. financial support for agricultural development in developing countries to more than $1 billion in 2010. And he's doing this because he recognizes how important it is that we can directly improve the lives of poor populations through broad-based agricultural growth. And he's making investments all the way through the chain with the idea that food will be more affordable and people will have a surplus and be able to move up through what they can get from selling their produce. So there are a number of areas that are being focused here. The one that I've underlined in green, I think, is the one that if I were you, I'd be paying very close attention to. They want to increase productivity and rural incomes by modernizing developing country agriculture through expanding development and use of modern technology, working in collaboration with U.S. land-grant universities, and strengthening host country research institutions. And the other issues are some of the downstream issues that I've mentioned. And they recognize that it isn't going to be enough to invest in technology development, but I think the fact that it's recognized that it's important is very exciting. The focus areas will include reducing the dependency on international food aid, and one of the ways in which they're going to do this is through education. I think that's very exciting. Perhaps there'll be more courses where we can really enable scientists in these countries to be able to take advantage of what we have to offer, and also to build multilateral partnerships, leveraging the strength of the private sector, NGOs, and of course our universities. There are a number of targeted countries, 25 countries and 8 regional-based programs, and the programs are going to be managed by the State Department and USAID. And you may not be aware, but about a year ago, NSF signed a memorandum of understanding with USAID that we would work together in programs. So I see the potential impact of BREAD going far beyond what we're doing just at NSF, and the impact of this funding should Congress decide to grant it to USAID far beyond what they do. So I think you can see that although the problems are very challenging and the outcome is somewhat, the future is somewhat daunting, I think we have an opportunity here to get a critical mass in some of these major areas that have really been neglected or at which we've been unsuccessful, and move to a new era in which I hope eventually we won't talk about developing country agriculture anymore. We'll just talk about agriculture, because frankly, I think the way things are going with climate change, we're all going to be facing problems of having too much rain, too little rain, and many other issues that have been such a problem elsewhere, but really haven't been a problem for us until now. So I really thank you for your attention. I hope you share my excitement about this new program, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
I'm the director of the Agriculture Biotechnology Support Project, which is a collaborative effort between USAID and Cornell University. Mm-hmm. One thing you hadn't mentioned that's very important is that the product development component of taking the science to the farm is a science in itself.
Yes, it is.
And I have found that I'm a former academic who went the biotech industry, back to academics. And the big gap is finding academics who can understand the product development component, the science part, and moving it from that science to the farm. And with the ABSB2 project, we seem to be doing a pretty good job of filling that gap. And I hope that there's some efforts in here, somewhere along the lines, to learn from what's been going on with a couple of these other institutions and not work in a vacuum.
No, we're not, definitely not. We're very interested in what's been successful. And if there are basic science components, we're interested in them in BREAD too. So I should have mentioned, and I was running out of time, so I speeded up a little bit, but I think, you know, the post-harvest issues, for example, that negatively impact ability to take things to the market are things that we would also be interested in supporting. So I hope that, you know, this network that we're beginning to be part of will include everybody that's interested in partnering with us.
I encourage questions from non-scientists, by the way, if there are questions on the message of scientists. Yes. I was not a senior educator, but that's the second. You mentioned the issues of global climate change that are going to affect the U.S., but what about also the issues of oil depletion as well, or fossil fuels used so intensively in agriculture? Mm-hmm. Is the process to look at ways to reduce that, not only for developing countries, but also for developed countries?
Absolutely. Yes, I think anything that can have an impact on, a positive impact on yield and food quality, of course. And, you know, we don't tend to focus on inputs in my part of the world, but you're exactly right that that is. I've tried to allude to the many complexities. There are so many that I actually didn't cover all of them in this talk. Frankly, it would have probably taken me 2 or 3 hours to go through all the constraints. So yes, you're exactly right. I think all of our efforts should look at the big picture and not just some of the focus areas that I've talked about here. Yes.
I was surprised to see that India has more number of people malnourished than any other countries. And I was wondering, there are many ways we could help the developing countries, but one of the major limitations is intellectual property rights and other issues. And is BREAD going to anyway resolve some of the issues or help the academic institutions?
So that's an interesting question. And in fact, you know, Dr. Delma has been very active in this area, and that's one of the reasons we really wanted her to be the program director for this program. So one of the things that you'll see in the program solicitation, hopefully it'll be out soon, is that we are going to ensure that where possible that everything be readily accessible in the hands of the people who need them with as few strings as possible. Now, obviously, we can't control the things that have already been patented and all the rest of it, but we're hoping that the outcomes from this program, at least, will not be constrained or constrained as little as possible.
One of the points which I noted in your slide is But you also noted that germplasm should be shared.
Yes.
But also, according to the new WTO organization,
yes,
we cannot share, supposed to share the germplasm.
Yes.
So how we are going to resolve that one?
Well, I think we're just going to have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. I think, you know, it's one of those things where you won't know a problem until you see it. And I think when we get to, but you're exactly right, there are certainly issues. Hopefully, we'll be able to work with what's in the public sector, and hopefully we'll be able to work out agreements that will enable what we're able to do. And I think we won't know until we get there what the problems are. Yes.
Norman Borlaug gave a talk to the panel a couple of years ago. One of the questions he got after the seminar, I don't know if he remembers it, but somebody said, when is there going to be the next green revolution? And he was very angered by that and said, the green revolution hasn't ended yet. So in your view, it did end 30 years ago.
I think that phase ended. And I was actually quoting a paper that talked about the green revolution as, you know, the first phase. But in fact, I don't think it's ended. I think it's morphed into something different. There may be other people who are more expert and work in this area than I, but I would agree with Borlaug, I should agree with Borlaug, that in fact it hasn't ended. But I think, you know, if you take the perspective of AGRA and look at the Green Revolution for Africa, what they're really looking at there is multiple green revolutions. And I think the thing that I'm learning, and I'm very much a student of this, probably as many of you are, that, you know, you cannot have generalized solutions to local specific problems. So I think that if we call something a green revolution, what it really is a lot of things going on underneath a large umbrella. That's my sense.